Good evening. I'm sorry not to be able to be with you tonight to receive this great honor of the D.W. Griffith Award, but I'm in London making Eyes Wide Shut with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, and just about this time I'm probably in the car on the way to the studio, which, as it happens, reminds me of a conversation I had with Steven Spielberg about what was the most difficult and challenging thing about directing a film. And I believe Steven summed it up about as profoundly as you can. He thought the most difficult and challenging thing about directing a film was getting out of the car. I'm sure you all know the feeling. But at the same time, anyone who has ever been privileged to direct a film also knows that although it can be like trying to write War and Peace in a bumper car in an amusement park, when you finally get it right, there are not many joys in life that can equal the feeling. I think there's an intriguing irony in naming the Lifetime Achievement Award after D.W. Griffith, because his career was both an inspiration and a cautionary tale. His best films will always rank among the most important films ever made, and some of them made him a great deal of money. He was instrumental in transforming movies from a Nickelodeon novelty to an art form, and he originated and formalized much of the syntax of movie making, now taken for granted. He became an international celebrity, and his patronage included many of the world's leading artists and statesmen of the time. But Griffith was always ready to take tremendous risks in his films and in his business affairs. He was always ready to fly too high. And in the end, the wings of fortune proved for him, like those of Icarus, to be made of nothing more substantial than wax and feathers. And like Icarus, when he flew too close to the sun, they melted. And the man whose fame exceeded the most illustrious filmmakers of today spent the last 17 years of his life shunned by the film industry he had created. I've compared Griffith's career to the Icarus myth, but at the same time, I've never been certain whether the moral of the Icarus story should only be, as is generally accepted, don't try to fly too high, or whether it might also be thought of as forget the wax and feathers and do a better job on the wings. One thing, however, is certain. D.W. Griffith left us with an inspiring and intriguing legacy, and the award in his name is one of the greatest honors a film director can receive. Something for which I humbly thank all of you very much.
You know, Stanley Kubrick filmed his famous movie Eyes Wide Shut inside the Rothschild family's country estate. Theories swirl that Kubrick made his movie about the real-life ultra elite and their secret occultic gatherings. Well, take a look at these pictures that show an actual Rothschild event from 1972. On the surface, it looks like a pretty magnificent surrealist ball, but there are clear occult references. Much like the film Eyes Wide Shut, occult imagery is hidden throughout the night, starting with the invitations, which were written backwards. Reversal or inversion of sacred objects is typical of black magic and satanic rituals. The exterior of the Chateau de Ferrier is lit up in a moving orange light, giving it the appearance of a fiery inferno. Here's some MK Ultra programming. Many guests are wearing masks with multiple faces. Victims of MK Ultra programming report systematic and ritualized pedophilia, drug and sexual abuse, and torture designed to deliberately shatter the minds of victims into multiple personalities called alters, which can be molded and manipulated at will. This hat, designed by Dali, also has hidden symbolism of androgyny by having half of Mona Lisa's face. Harnessing the male and female power is important to practitioners of the left-hand path. And although Dali traditionally paints ants and grasshoppers in his paintings to evoke death, decay, and trauma, this work of art has scarab beetles, which symbolize the Egyptian mysticism of Osiris, the Sun King. Bird cages weren't just a popular costume, but they also symbolize physical and psychological bondage. This guest's costume resembles the famous painting Son of Man by Magritte. Both the apple and the eye of Horus symbolize the forbidden knowledge of Lucifer in the Garden of Eden. The hostess, Marie-Hélène de Rothschild, is seen wearing a giant horned head, crying real diamond tears. Is this a representation of the sacrifice to Baphomet, who will share wealth and riches only after sacrifice? It's not exactly clear when in 1972 this party took place, but from the look of the decorations and the menu, it's definitely a fertility ritual. The dinner table serves dismembered dolls and cracked skulls. A possible reference to MKUltra doll programming and the lifelessness of their victims who literally crack after their mind control wiring goes haywire. For dessert, a human sacrifice in a bed of roses. The rose, of course, is a symbol used by many secret societies, and it represents virginity, fertility, sexuality, and immortality, as well as silence and secrecy. Here's Salvador Dali, who helmed the surrealist movement. At first, this could seem like a surrealism party in his honor. But consider the aims of the surrealism movement itself: to resolve the contradictory condition of dreams versus reality and allow the unconscious mind to express itself. Occult imagery is very real, and it's everywhere, in movies, television, music, and fashion. The power derived from these occult symbols and imagery is very real to the elitists that congregate in their separate reality.
So shall we burn thee once again this night? And in the flames that eat thine effigy, we shall read the sign, Midsummer sets us free.
Ye shall burn me once again.
Not with these flames.
Summer sets us free.
And that is just the tip of the iceberg. The elites are riddled with perverse secret societies that are obsessed with harnessing the power of dark forces.
For over 100 years, Skull and Bones members have included a president, vice presidents, Supreme Court justices, congressmen and senators, captains of science and industry, the very best of America.
They were before, the advisor, and they're better.
There's the public perception of the occult and then what is actually happening. It's fantasy and folklore versus the real and tangible dark power that the elite are able to harness by being practitioners of the occult. And it's this very art and imagery that we see over and over again, that it's just the expression of their dark souls.
Yeah.
All right. Because people might say, well, why are you bothering to look at this? What's the point? Why are you looking into his background? If it is a lie, the moon landings, if they were faked, as a lot of people now believe, it's a massive lie. As Bart Zabrell said, it's just a satanic lie. And it needs to be exposed. So yeah. Looking into the background of Kubrick is important. Now you've split your research up into three areas.
Yeah.
I'll just tell the viewers what they are, and then we'll go down into each one.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the connections that Kubrick had with certain key people who were linked to NASA and other organizations.
Yeah.
The clues in the films themselves, as we've just
predominantly
mentioned.
The Shining is the main film, but there are clues in other films as
right.
well. Yeah.
And also other films that have been produced which put forward the case that Kubrick was involved, but do it in a really bad way to make people think that no, he
yeah.
wasn't really involved.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of a limited hangout.
Yeah, yeah.
So what connections did he have?
First of all, I wanted to sort of quote from this article, but it's called Dr. Strangelove, A Strange and Terrible Glimpse into the Deep State. I don't know the name of the author, but it really sums up Kubrick, sort of where he is. Basically, the author says, Kubrick seems to have been aligned, probably very loosely, with what I like to refer to as the Anglo-American establishment. When typical conspiracy theorists rail against the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the international bankers, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and so forth, this is essentially who they're referring to. But this is not the only power elite within the international community or even the United States itself. One of the most compelling aspects of Dr. Strangelove is its nuanced view of the American power structure and the confirmation it gives of a divide within the structure of the organisations. So certainly if you look at Dr. Strangelove, which is a real condemnation of the military-industrial complex, you can sort of see that he's allied sort of to a group that opposes that sort of.
Right.
Basically, it's just showing the ineptitude of the people in power, and it's instigates a nuclear war, basically, mm-hmm. and the end of the world. And the total incompetence of everybody involved, the Russians, the Americans, and no one has a clue what anybody's doing and who holds the keys, basically, to setting up the bombs and that, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Did Kubrick then actually make certain connections with high up people in the making of that film? Then?
He did, yes, yeah. I mean, one of his consultants was this chap called Alistair Francis Buchan, who was the director of International Institute for Strategic Studies, which is effectively connected to the Round Table Group, Kissinger, the Rothschilds, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he actually pointed Kubrick to the film's inspiration for the film, which was Peter George's novel, Red Alert. Peter George was also known as Peter Bryant. And he was a British intelligence officer as well. So,
right.
Also a couple of other things, Sterling Hayden, who played Brigadier General Jack Ripper in the film, had an extensive career in the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA as well. So yeah, so a few connections there even at that point. So
right. And then we come on to 2001, A Space Odyssey. So I understand that Kubrick consulted people at NASA for this particular. So what would the reason for that be then?
It's basically been put across that he wanted it to be as accurate as possible. He wanted it to sort of reflect what was going on with NASA at that time. He wanted it to be sort of an extension of the technology that NASA was allegedly creating at that point. So
yeah.
So he brought on a lot of people involved with NASA. Clark himself was heavily involved with NASA. He had high connections in NASA. But he had these two principal scientific advisors on the film, Frederick Ira Ordway III and Harry Langer. Ordway was a former member of the American Rocket Society, space scientist, and author of technical books about space flight. He worked with ballistic rockets until 1960, followed by 3 years at Marshall Space Flight Center. So he was, you know. And Langer was an illustrator and designer for the aerospace industry, head of NASA's Future Project section.
And so if we go on to The Shining, because what you would possibly claim is that Kubrick was very uncomfortable if indeed he did film some of the hoaxed moon landings, very uncomfortable that he'd been asked to do that.
That's the contention,
and
yeah.
He can't possibly speak about it because he'd get murdered.
Well, I mean, some people say that eventually did happen to him, but yeah.
So he's trying to tell everyone about this using a different layer in particular in The Shining.
Yeah.
So just tell us what the clues are then.
It's subtext, really. I mean, there's been a number of researchers have pointed out loads and loads of examples, so I'm not sort of pointing out anything original here. This is what a lot of other researchers have put. There's this scene where Jack Nicholson's character, Jack Torrance, is interviewed by the manager, and people say that's a metaphorical sort of his induction into whatever NASA was getting Kubrick involved with. the presence of the Eagles in the film. There's one on Jack Torrance's t-shirt. There's one in the office in the window. People say like the Eagle has landed. Also the typewriter that he types all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy on it. You know, that's an Adler typewriter, which the word for Adler in German word is Eagle, basically. In German, it's Adler. In the room where the typewriter is, there's these Indian totems that are painted on the wall. I don't know if they're like a tapestry or something like that, but they're basically, some people say they look like the Saturn V rockets taking off. There's also this really interesting scene where Torrance's son, Danny, is sitting playing with his toys on the carpet in the corridor. He's got a jumper on, which has got an Apollo, a white rocket on it, which is Apollo 11 USA on it. Some people say that the hexagon pattern on the carpet vaguely resembles the Saturn V launch pad and things like that. So.
Now, one of the most important things in your research, Carl, was to try and discover the first reference to Stanley Kubrick being involved in the moon hoaxes.
Allegedly.
And various stuff was put out in the 1990s to suggest that this sort of idea came around in the 1990s.
Yeah, it's just new at that point,
Tell us what you've discovered.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I actually fell for some degree as well. You know, I needed to do a lot more research and find out. But basically, what I call a limited hangout, effectively. It's a bit like sort of 9/11 and ufology, that sort of, you have these limited hangout, and they're pushing this time frame that it's there in the 1990s.
Because there was a documentary made called The Dark Side of the Moon, which you call a mockumentary.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people say that.
It had all of these important people in it, like Kissinger and Donald Rumsfeld and a whole load of others, and even Kubrick's own ex-wife or widow. So just give us a quick summary of that, because a lot of people will watch that on YouTube.
They'll
see the flaws in it, and they'll go, well, yeah, he didn't really do it, did he?
Or there's
confusion over it.
Yeah, so just it can mislead people in any number of ways. I mean, you can look at it and say, well, this is just so ridiculous. It is obvious that it's faked. I mean, you only have to look at the people involved in it. I mean, certainly at least seven of the people that are alleged, and they're actually the only ones that mention Kubrick in it. They're all actors playing characters. And it's not hard to see that. I mean, the giveaways are in the names. I mean, one of the alleged whistleblowers in it is called Dave Bowman, which is the name of the character from 2001, the commander of the ship. And Dmitry Muffly, and Muffly, the respective leaders of the US and Russia in Dr. Strangelove. You know, Jack Torrance is the name of Jack Nicholson's character in The Shining. So these are the people that they're saying that these are these people. You know,
but this isn't a low budget documentary, is it?
No. I mean, it was produced for.
This is like a mainstream documentary that's got obviously a lot of research in it and a lot of preparation.
Yeah. It was Franco-German TV network RT, not Russian RT, ARTE, 2002, called Operation Loon. So it went out on a fairly mainstream channel in France. And
in that film, although they weren't directly referring to Kubrick, they've been taken out of context.
You've
got Rumsfeld and Kissinger.
Yeah, yeah.
They've not actually complained of the beams that. Been in
that? No, they haven't. I mean, the source for it is not widely known, but I have been able to track it down.
What you did was you've compared another documentary with several of the people in that documentary and proved that they've stolen footage from another
documentary. I've compared the two. I haven't been able to sync up the exact sections that they're talking, but you only have to look at it. They're wearing the same clothes, the same room that they're sitting in, same hairstyle, same background, everything, same lighting, and they're talking about political leaders.
Yeah, so what they've done, they've picked up what was left on the cutting room floor from one documentary.
But it was directed by William Carroll, the same chap who directed.
Right. Okay.
So he's used his own material previously. You know?
Yeah.
But again, like you say, they never objected to it. They didn't seem to care about the fact that this footage had been reused.
And let's be clear, that documentary is trying to assert that Kubrick was involved.
Yeah,
but doing it in a completely debunkable way.
Yeah.
This is like three-dimensional chess, and he's trying to tell us several stories that appear to be separate, but actually are not. And he's doing this both through the overt script that he wrote. He's telling it through tricks of the trade, the subliminal imagery, and these constant retakes giving him odd angles and things. And he's also telling you through the changes that he made to the Stephen King novel. So if you watch those three things, you begin to understand this deeper story. And this deeper story has its birth, I guess, in the idea that Stanley Kubrick was involved with faking the Apollo moon landings. In fact, I contend that 2001 Space Odyssey, in part, was a research and development project for the Apollo footage that was shot. I'm not saying we didn't go to the moon, I'm just saying that what we saw was faked, and that it was faked by Stanley Kubrick. And I've had Hollywood special effects people from the 60s and 70s who were front screen projection experts tell me that I absolutely have nailed the Apollo footage as being the result of front screen projection. Just go to any Apollo site and look, and you'll see that they have to hide the bottom of the screen, and you can always see the set screen separation line in every Apollo footage. Every Apollo image and the video footage that has a background. And Richard Hoagland, the researcher, has looked into the Apollo imagery, and he has found all sorts of problems with it, because in the sky around the astronauts, he's found reflecting lights and refracting things and kind of a junk and geometry and things that are in the sky. And he concluded, wrongly, that there are gigantic alien cities made out of glass. What he's really saying is the reflections of light off the tiny beads on the scotch light screen, which is being used in the front screen projection process. And so once I nailed the front screen projection process inside the Apollo footage, then I became interested in seeing if Kubrick left any clues in the rest of his career to his possible involvement in faking the Apollo moon footage. And I was overjoyed about 2 years ago. No, that's actually not true. If you call the Mount Hood Resort and you ask for room 217, you will find there is no such room. So that's just not true. That statement's not true. And so Stanley was lying. You know, it's not the reason that he changed the room number from 217 to 237. The reason that he changed it from 217 to 237 was because the room 237 in the film represents the moon landing stage where he worked. And the moon, the standard science textbooks said, and they still say, but now with lasers we've gotten a little better reading, but is that the mean distance of the moon from the Earth is exactly 237,000 miles. So he changed that so that you would understand that this was the moon room. So Danny stands up, he's got the Apollo 11 sweater on, he begins walking down the hallway towards room 237, and there's a key in the lock, and on the key is the words room, and then the word NO, which is an old acronym for number, so room number 237, except that the only capital letters on the key are ROOM and then the N from the acronym NO. And if there's only two words that you can come up with that have those letters in them, and that's moon and room. And so on the key, the tag, it says moon room. and that is the moon room. This is where everything happens, and none of it's real, and it all has to be lied about, and we can't let anyone know what's really going on in room 237.
Or other cultures where they would kill a ram, or in the case of folks like the founder of the three major religions, Abraham, where he was told, kill your son, but then the angel stayed his hand. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly a serious magic ritual. The men in attendance took it very, very serious. I, on purpose, standing out in that cathedral under the redwoods, would try to talk to them a few times during the hour and a half ritual, and they looked at me like they wanted to murder me. I was just like, oh, this is very interesting. And they were in religious rapture. They believed that they were being passed over like the children of Israel there in Egypt when spirit of death, the Grim Reaper, was coming down as a green mist coiling through up to kill all the firstborn. So they believed that they were ritualistically putting blood on their doorways, and they were taking it extremely seriously. And at that moment, I went, wow, this is really people who believe in the occult. This is a good chunk of the world elite. This is where Star Wars was hatched, the weapon system, not the movie. This is where the Manhattan Project was hatched for atomic weapons. This is where secret deals were made with the Soviets. That's all been in the newspaper since. This is one of the most important places in the world. I mean, even former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt wrote in his memoirs, Men and Powers, a political retrospective, that more important decisions were made at Bohemian Grove than even Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission or other big events. But he said, we have our own groves in Germany. Mm-hmm. Where we also make our decisions.
Yeah.
So it really gives you an inside view into how they're working and how they have this esoteric knowledge that we can poo-poo. You know, atheists can poo-poo, and I see why they poo-poo it. It looks like a bunch of mumbo-jumbo voodoo, except these people are running the world, and they believe they're contacting entities beyond the veil in other dimensions, which mathematics shows us is there,
right.
And are getting temporal power on this third-dimensional plane.
Absolutely. And actually, your story reminds me of the Tom Cruise character in Eyes Wide Shut, right? And he's entering into this realm. It's like, you're not supposed to be here. This is forbidden power. And if, as a result of crossing, basically, now you're on their radar, and sometimes you can be threatened. Were you ever threatened as a result? Were you ever threatened by anything more, say, subtle, beyond just sort of overt comments, but anything subtly mentioned to you?
I am not a practitioner of magic and of basically sorcery. And we see it stylized in movies. We see a lot of weak people who get held up as sorcerers, who are weak people looking for power, who dress up in clown suits. But the deeper you research how the world elite operate, they see themselves as sorcerers of mathematics, of technology, of world rule. And they understand, whether they're good or bad, because they're both, that there is all these dimensions around us and all these synchronicities and serendipities that connect together. And so the fact that I got in, got past the Secret Service, got out, they even broke in somebody's hotel room that I made copies of the tapes for, Channel 4 in London, World of Wonder, they erased those. I mailed them to their LA studios, they erased those. I finally had to mail them to another address. They thought I was BSing them. You know, before they finally got the tapes, because they'd actually paid me to be able to have the funding to sneak inside. They even had an insider who gave me some of the code words, and I'm not really supposed to get into all that. Mm-hmm. But the system did death threat me some, but that was some of the people. And then others basically said, listen, you're the establishment infiltrating us. We're the Renaissance. You're actually Satan fighting God. We're God. And I actually had some high-level folks say, if you really want to know what this is all about, we'll invite you to some of our meetings. And then they contacted me and said, well, look at your family. You've got some 33rd degree Masons in your lineage. Your family, I'm not bragging, but it's true, like basically was heavily involved on both sides founding Texas. And my family was on the Mayflower and a bunch of other stuff. And they actually esoterically went through the stuff and looked me up and said, oh, well, you were just supposed to be the one that infiltrated and exposed this. Mm-hmm. So they're really into bloodlines. They're into a whole bunch of other stuff. And they've basically translated to me that, okay, well, if you don't join us, you're just a dumbass because you're supposed to be one of us anyways. Mm-hmm. And so then in their weird esoteric view, I was supposed to sneak in and bring it all out. And then maybe they let the TV station come to me a year before, tell me, will you do this? Because I'd stuck into military bases and covered some other stuff. They were scared to do it. And so maybe I was actually allowed in. Some people have said that, but I was questioned by the Secret Service, the local sheriff department, and others. And they were seriously looking for folks. And I believe I successfully, you know, got past them. But who knows, you know, how all this stuff really worked. Very strange realm.
So speaking of the high strangeness, you interviewed Vivian Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick's daughter, and obviously her father has done films that deal with the power elite and how things are run from the military side, from the space program angle, from pedophilia to mind control. So his final film, Eyes Wide Shut, was that, did she portray it like that was his sort of his insight into sneaking in and how he himself was the Cruise character sort of observing this realm of high magic and sexual ritual?
Absolutely. He exposed, you know, psychic powers with The Shining. He exposed ritualistic pedophilia, ritualistic sacrifice, ritualistic sex. He exposed humans having, as you said on my show today, when you were on as a guest, challenging the AI before humans go to the next level of development, interdimensional gates, you name it. The French Revolution, he covered it all, you know, from paths of glory and all the rest of it. He's exposed it all. Probably the master filmmaker out there, if there are any. You maybe your dad, you know, is a close second. But looking at this, it's part of my job that when somebody really prominent comes to me that's talked to nobody else and then says, I'm going to tell you all this, but you can't tell anybody what I told you, then it's very frustrating about Fukushima and she wants to have dinner tonight. And so I'm in the car and I see her out there with the crowd and I Google it and it's Vivian Kubrick. And I'm like, wow, it isn't just his daughter. It's his protege, kind of co-directed Full Metal Jacket in some of his films. She didn't want the attention or be in a shadow, but she kind of co-directed, did the music. I mean, it's come out she was the only one in the family that he wanted to associate with at the end. And she was the chosen one by Kubrick. But then I went and had dinner with her for 2 days, hung out with her for 2 days. Then she came on the show in Austin, and then she wanted to come down in Austin and really spill her guts. And then a bunch of weird stuff happened. All hell broke loose. I'm not liberty to get into it against me domestically here in Austin, but also in Dallas. And then she ended up going to Florida and has been off the radar screen. But I mean, my life changed big time when I met Vivian Kubrick, and then that's all I can say. Mm-hmm. And she filled in a lot of the dots, a lot of the puzzle pieces. It was amazing. She's only done like one other interview in 15 years.
Right.
And she told me basically the whole nine yards. And I don't want to get killed over this. She didn't get the specifics or names or any of it. But she just basically what I can tell you is her father was tortured by what he knew. Most of it was because he was highly psychic, and nobody's ever said this. I mean, I was told this, but it's clear. Because I knew separately, reading books about him, my mom and dad being a big fan, taking me to his films when they would show when I was a kid, you know, when they were re-airing them, everything from Spartacus to Paths of Glory to 2001 Space Odyssey to Full Metal Jacket to you name it. And she was telling me all this stuff like, well, you know why he did The Shining, because that's all about how people are psychic and have these connections. Well, and you know, he got visited by the CIA and the FBI and MI6, and how do you know all this? And he didn't know it all. He was basically envisioning it all in his earlier films. So they came to him and said, how do you know this? Because he was even getting stuff right in Dr. Strangelove, like down to the code numbers. And they were like, how do you know this? And he just knew it. So that's really the secret of Stanley Kubrick is he was like putting out a psychic vision of, I can't believe I'm actually not doing this on my own show. I've never actually talked about this, but I can't get into all of it.
Right.
But man, the stuff she told me, if anything is, and that's what they're doing. Satanism isn't a hot cheerleader in devil horns dancing on a table.
Right.
That's how they sell it as hot and cool.
Yeah.
Satanism is detonating hydrogen bombs on the upper atmosphere, trying to blow holes in the Van Allen radiation belt and destroy our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Satanism is splicing thousands of crops together and creating human-animal hybrid chimeras that don't even have a use but to be miserable. That is what we're facing. And there's a very, very dark force. You know, Kubrick's daughter told me that basically her mother and her sister, according to her and others, gave in to the incredible pressure.
Yeah.
She talked about what they sent against her father, what they sent against her, and why he reclused himself. She contacts us sometimes, then says she's going to come on and talk, and then all hell breaks loose. But let me tell you, what the Kubricks know is important, because I talk to so many famous people. I'm not a star, you know, bleeper. I don't obsess over that. I mean, I might have been into it a little bit 10 years ago, not as much as others, but I mean, I get it's all a bunch of narcissism. It doesn't matter unless you're using the position to promote liberty and freedom. But I kind of took it nonchalantly. Okay, she hasn't talked to anybody for 15 years. Okay, you know, she used to, you know, whatever with Harrison Ford. Okay, this lady's a big deal. She used to hang out with all the, you know, all the top people. Used to be best buddies with Steven Spielberg. Okay, this is the protege of Stanley Kubrick. And I'm just hanging out with her, and she's telling me stuff she's never told anybody. And I look it up. No, she's never told anybody this. And I just nonchalantly don't even worry about it, and actually don't even talk about it. And then I realized just the last few months, I knew it then, while all hell broke loose, was because I was told all this stuff, and they major league came against me when I wouldn't even talk about the stuff because it was said in private. Plus, there's not much more she told me.
Hey. What's going on with y'all, man? It's Black Balloon, and I'm coming back with another video, so y'all already know what's going on. All right, that was a long 36 minutes before I could actually come in and talk to y'all. I guess y'all could thank a few people for kind of convincing me to go back to the old ways of how I used to do the videos. Now, a reason I really don't do them this way anymore is because of YouTube and the guidelines, you know, the community guidelines on being monetized and so on and so on. It doesn't necessarily allow me to play certain clips at a certain amount of time, you know, without them giving me strikes and giving me copyrights and all of that good stuff. But I figured for this video, I was going to go all out. Really dig and find everything that I could that related to Stanley Kubrick, the faked Apollo 11 moon landings, and one of his most profound films in Eyes Wide Shut. The film that everyone today still talks about, and, you know, we still give out theories of what it all could have possibly meant. Now, we don't get any of these from Stanley Kubrick himself, considering he died before this film was actually released, which is a tell-all in itself. He died in March of 1999. The film was released later in September of the exact same year, 1999, September 3rd, as we went over earlier in the video. Now, before I just kind of get into it and, you know, give my thoughts on the entire video, I hope y'all really enjoyed that video. It was fun, and it was, you know, it was really interesting to go back down a lot of this stuff about Stanley Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut. You know, a good bit of this stuff I kind of, you know, already knew and researched, you know, way back when this was something I did way before YouTube, just, you know, just finding out truth about things. But a lot of this stuff I didn't know, because a lot of the interviews I showed you I had never heard before, and making the connections to basically how far up the ladder Stanley Kubrick was connected to high levels of government, the CIA, NASA, so on and so on. He was, you know, basically a well-known man, a highly connected man. He had a lot of connections in a lot of places in government and really high, you know, levels of government. So, you know, it was, as I put in the text, you know, going over that stuff, it completely dismisses the fact that, you know, he was not basically capable of the things that he was showing us in films. And the fact that he basically helped the government stage the moon landing. which, you know, as was said in one of the clips earlier, that that is a huge lie. That is a satanic lie. You know, that's deception at its finest in fooling the public that we actually landed on the moon. In sort of a a race to space, as they say, at least back then, you know. So that's definitely a huge satanic lie. Because all it does is it keeps one bigger picture lie, you know, in motion, as in that this Earth, this world is a spinning ball flying through space, and we can actually go up there and witness it and see it for ourselves. So yes, that is a satanic lie, because that is a complete, that is completely fucking false. No one can go outside of this world and see what the creation looks like, nor can they witness anything outside of this creation. It was never intended that way. God didn't make this creation for any of us to actually see outside of it but himself. So please, if you ever believe that we landed on the moon and we were actually way up there and we could see the world and see everything else from the moon, please, if you believe that, I need you to just bring it down. And I don't know, but I need you to toss all of those thoughts out of your head, because it's completely false. It is not true. We have never been to the moon. And the moon is actually inside of Earth's atmosphere. It's really not that far, but we've definitely never been there. All right. So with that being said, we'll kind of move on to Eyes Wide Shut, the film in itself. Now, I wanted to give you all of those Alex Jones clips and that clip way in the beginning of the video, so you could actually get like a good visual of what the movie was actually about, what it was actually detailing, what it was actually exposing as far as child pedophilia, as far as human sacrifice, as far as just deep occultic rituals. You know, seeing this man in the red cloak, this was a ritual in itself, in the movie, literally. And even I can't play it for y'all. I really wish I could, because it would really like just give this video the entire vibe I was looking for. But there is that short clip in the beginning of the video that y'all could go back, and obviously you can go and watch the real clip yourself on YouTube or just wherever the clip is posted. But there are clips on YouTube of this specific scene, which is about 2 minutes and 30 seconds long, which is, you know, probably the most profound scene in the entire movie, was this ritual that they were showing. Now, the guy in the red cloak, which is why I said I really wish I could play y'all this right now, but it would probably get me a copyright strike. I really wish I could, because it would just set the tone for the video. And at the same time, I don't want to play it, because it's basically like enchanting. He's chanting something over and over, and it almost sounds like he's chanting. He's doing it in reverse, so it has a certain psychological effect on your mind. Because I think I read it's some kind of like Romanian Orthodox, some kind of song. I can't really remember, but he's singing it in reverse. So it has a different effect on your mind. You know what I'm saying? I don't know exactly what he's saying, but it's basically black magic. Black magic details, you know, it details hypnotism and chanting, but it doesn't have to always be in words. That's the thing. But when it's in words, it has those different effects on your mind, because it's being said either, no, it can be said either forward or backward, which kind of hypnotizes you. Which is why when I did this video and I did all this research on it, it took me about a week to really compile all this stuff and just get it to where I could present it to y'all in a way that you would understand it and receive it, you know. So this particular part, it got stuck in my head for 2 days. For 2 days, I just kept saying, whoa, whoa, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was literally stuck in my head. And that goes back to basically what music does to you, in a sense. It's all the same, because we know a lot of songs, they're based off of black magic as well. Like certain hooks and shit that you hear that literally sticks in your head. It's a form of black magic. It's a form of hypnotism. They're enchanting you. They're getting in your psyche. You see what I'm saying? It has an effect on your mental, which is why you start to repeat it, because it's planted. The frequency has planted itself into your mind, into your brain. And so now you start to receive the feeling, the vibration from what they're actually putting onto you. And so that's kind of why, you know, this part doesn't really need to be in the video, although it would be cool as fuck, but it doesn't really need to be, because you literally would be listening to a ritual. And it's gonna get stuck in your head. Like, it's literally gonna get stuck in your head. I'm pretty sure some of y'all are gonna go back and watch this specific scene, and I guarantee you that part is gonna get stuck in your head. Like, if I was you, I wouldn't even really watch it that long. I would just skim through it, just in case you want to be kind of reminded of this scene. So, you know, it was just, I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain the way it makes you feel. But, you know, when y'all go back and kind of look it up for yourself, you'll get what I'm saying. Now, the movie, you know, a lot of people have their theories about what the movie detailed. Now, if you even go and watch the movie, you'll see a bunch of things that we actually talk about on this channel, especially about the part where the girl basically gave herself up in order to save Tom Cruise's character. The girl basically sacrificed herself. Now, another thing that this proves that all the times that we get that an artist or a celebrity OD'd, this goes to show us that they will put out a celebrity or a certain artist OD'd when really they were actually sacrificed. Because that's what this news article detailed in Eyes Wide Shut. The news article said that the girl overdosed. But clearly, in the movie, she was actually a ritual sacrifice. She gave herself up to save his character. So if that's not, you know, convincing evidence enough of the fact that they sacrificed these people who they say OD'd, think about all the recent ODs we've gotten, you know, Michael K. Williams, Shock G. So on and so on. I don't feel like thinking of all the people that's been, you know, ODs lately and stuff in the news. But just think about all the ones that we get. And we get on here and make videos because it's fishy. It doesn't sound right. You know, we're like, oh, nah, this wasn't an OD. We know this was a sacrifice. So think about it. We're not wrong. I'm not wrong. You're not wrong for believing that. It's literally right here in the movie. This ain't even a movie. This is a documentary. This is an expose. This is literally telling you what's going on. And then the fact that, you know, there's this theory out there that 20 to 30 minutes of the footage was actually scrubbed off and we didn't even really get the entire scene. And that could be very true because there was a lot of editing done after the movie was turned in. After the screening of the movie, which supposedly he died shortly after. So there's footage that we will never, you know, we will never actually see if that's actually true. So we're not wrong. We're not wrong. The movie literally gives it to us right on a platter. And it's heavy, you know, heavy symbolism as far as child pedophilia as well. And also MK Ultra sex kittens, because basically all the women were basically under mind control. That's literally the picture he painted in this scene throughout the movie. Even at the end of the movie, I think it was the owner of the store or something. I forget what he was. I think he was like the owner of the store that he was getting a tux from or something like that. I can't exactly remember that part, but he offered his daughter to Tom Cruise. So I mean, there you have it. It's right there in your face. I don't even have to really go down into detail about it. For the most part, I really want y'all to go and watch it. And, you know, I know a lot of y'all don't seen the movie, but, you know, now that we're kind of just making it a little bit more relevant again, you know, go back and watch it and just take it in. And you're going to see, after we've been going over so much of this stuff lately on the channel, you know, a lot more things are going to make sense. Like, you're not going to feel crazy anymore for thinking all of these things, because this movie actually detailed it way back in 1999. 22 years ago. It definitely confirms that we are not crazy and this stuff actually goes on, you know? All of this stuff, all that Epstein Island child sex trafficking, all that stuff is real, and it was basically depicted in this movie. So, you know, with that being said, y'all, you know, I'm gonna wrap this video up. I didn't want to just go too much of repeating the same stuff about this scene and about the movie. That's why I added those clips, so you don't, you know, you're not hearing everything from me as in me trying to convince you that this stuff is real. You're hearing it from other sources. So I feel like that did the video, you know, I feel like it did it justice, especially the Eyes Wide Shut part, and just, you know, all the symbolism that surrounded the movie in itself, and the way Stanley Kubrick, you know, chose to direct his films. And unfortunately, he was ritually sacrificed himself at the age of 70 years old. They say at first that there was no cause of death, and then they reported that there was a heart attack, supposedly. We would never be able to prove that. And yeah, man, and that's that. He was sacrificed by the death cult. That's pretty much what they are. They're the order of death is real, y'all. That's all I can say, man. So y'all already know what's going on. I really hope y'all enjoyed that video as I enjoyed making it, and you know, I was pretty excited to get it out to y'all. So yeah, man, that's that. It's today's Tuesday. I hope y'all have a good week. Y'all already know what's going on. It's Black Balloon. And I'm gonna see y'all soon. I'm out.